Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today, we have some news on KCTF disabling a particular subsystem, a log me in handle duplication issue in Windows, and a Linux bug, another one of those Linux kernel bugs that impacts user space. That's going to be quite interesting. We'll lead off, though, with the KCTF topic. So this was a tweet that I saw by Hombre. They do Linux kernel research, and he had mentioned that KCTF recently disabled NF tables as a surface in the main instance after researchers pivoted to it after IOU ring was disabled. Very excited to see what service gets scrutinized next. The new rules, though, make it where 0 days are disclosed much less often. So this was quite an interesting one. So I think we've talked before about the fact that KCTF had disabled IOU ring in their instance, because there was literally one point where every submission to KCTF was an IOU ring issue, because security researchers are always going to go for the path of least resistance. And that's kind of continued on, because after they disabled IOU ring, they enabled netfilter tables or NF tables, which may sound familiar to some of you, even if you're not in the Linux kernel space, because we've talked about a fair amount of issues in that subsystem as well. ZDI has published quite a few advisories that were vulnerabilities in that area. We cover some other write-ups. And yeah, it was a bit of a bug farm. So that's where people moved to after IOU ring. And I guess they were getting tired of submissions from that too. So they ended up disabling NF tables in their instance too. So this was kind of brought up. It says they're like, you know, very excited to see what service gets scrutinized next, which it will be interesting to see where the meta shifts to. But there's also that last point. The new rules, though, make it to where 0 days are disclosed much less often. And that's kind of what I took away from this. And I really don't know if I like that direction that KCTF seems to be going. Without U-Ring at the time, I was kind of like, okay, that makes sense. It's kind of insane how people are just farming this one subsystem. And it's very new subsystem, very active in development. So it makes sense, like, just disable it. But now that they've done it again, it's like, okay, are they just going to play whack-a-mole, basically, with these vulnerable subsystems? Because if they are, it makes me question, what are they trying to achieve with KCTF, right? Because from the jump, people could have told you that IOU ring and NF tables were bug farms. They didn't really need to run the Vuln research program and pay out hundreds of thousands of dollars to get that insight. It was kind of already known. So from what I gathered about KCTF was the point of it was not only to survey the vulnerability landscape and see where vulnerabilities are coming from and whatnot, but also on the exploit landscape to see how bugs are getting exploited, see the techniques that are being used, how those could potentially be mitigated, which is why they also launched their mitigation instance. So I don't know. I don't really know if I think, basically, I'll put it like this. I don't think disabling subsystems like this makes sense for the future of KCTF, because as Hombre said in the last sentence here, I think it's going to result in less submissions overall, which is going to give them less data to operate off of, because people don't want to burn core kernel bugs for the same amount of money that was getting paid out for like NF table bugs, right? So, yeah, I don't really like the direction. It feels kind of weird to say, because on premise, if you have a vulnerable subsystem that's causing a lot of issues, like, sandboxing is an important security thing. Like, you want to isolate off those kinds of areas from being hittable by attackers. It totally makes sense from a defender perspective to sandbox and disable off things like this. But with KCTF and the competition aspect specifically, I don't know if I like that direction. And I think, Z, you kind of have an opinion, an opposing view on this.
Yeah, so I see where you're coming from on the concern. And I would kind of share the concern that is this going to become a whack-a-mole where Google just ends up disabling like every subsystem that gets several bugs in it because, you know, whatever. But at the same time, I think like on their Android subsystem, on a hardened system, attack service reduction is important. So if they've used KCTF to identify an area that should have reduced access, should be a bit more privileged off, whatever, like that feels like a gain that they're going to, you know, adopt this hardening throughout. And it's not just for KCTF that they're doing this, but I assume they also then apply the same idea elsewhere. And the O-Day aspect of it. Like, I feel like Kernel CTF is at least a little bit more about end-day techniques. Like, you could leverage O-days here with, like, NF tables with IOU ring because they were less usable on, like, Android for the bounty there. And they're still going to be paying bounties on, like, the O-days for at least Android impacting bugs. So
yeah, you kind of brought this up, but maybe we should talk about it just for people who might not be familiar with KCTF, because we're kind of just talking about it operating under the assumption that everyone knows what we're talking about. So KCTF, Kernel CTF, it was launched by Google. We've talked about it a bit before. Getting into a quick summary, it's basically where you can submit exploits either on O-days or N-days, and they can pay out for those submissions. So they have like a base reward of like $20,000 or whatever for issues that affect the latest LTS instance that they have up. And then they also have bonuses for stability. So if it's like high reliability, they'll pay out more. If it's an O-day, they'll pay out more. If it's in an area that's less privileged, they will also pay more. So they have like a bonus incentive structure, and that's the whole idea with it. And they have launched things like the KCTF cookbook, where they examine the submissions, see what kind of exploit strategies are being used. And they've also tried to develop some hardening techniques on the kernel to mitigate exploit strategies that are common. So that's kind of what their goal is. As he mentioned there, it is worth noting, they do accept non-zero days. So this is mainly impacting on the O-day front, or at least more immediately it's impacting on the O-day front. So yeah, I mean, that is a fair thing to bring up. And I just wanted to elaborate a bit on the nuances of KCTF, just for anyone who might not have been familiar with it.
Yeah, that's definitely an important thing to bring up. And we just kind of skipped over it because this has been something we've talked about somewhat recently with KCTF expanding to KVM CTF and V8 CTF. So we did kind of talk about somewhat recently, but still, good to call that out. It isn't like a vulnerability program where it's just here are new bugs. Specifically, they are using this thing to test on the exploitation side. Like, I think they care more about getting novel exploits than about getting novel vulnerabilities, because the vulnerabilities will come through like kind of the other programs that they have, at least in the areas they care. Although one nice thing with KCTF for a while was that this was a place where bugs that maybe wouldn't have a ton of value anywhere else could still kind of, you could find value, you could leverage them for some value by, you know, writing a full exploit for, right, going after like the mitigation instance for the bonus there, or seeing if it lasts on like their LTS and stuff. And I guess that is one note, like their latest LTS instance, like, they do use their COS kernel, their container-oriented kernel configuration, which is kind of what's being used. So it's the latest LTS, but they do have a separate COS instance, which is the kernel config and setup used within, I think, within the Google Cloud in general. GKE here, I think, is that not the Kubernetes specifically, like that service, which... I'm seeing the GKE.
Google Kubernetes GKE. Engine.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. So I guess it's maybe just used there. I thought it might be used also within general cloud. Either way, I imagine they're using Kubernetes within cloud stuff anyhow. So it's probably there in the stack regardless. Either way, like, in my opinion, the hardening is part of it. And so when they find something that, hey, we can lock this down, we can harden this, my opinion is it's fair for them to do so. But I would be afraid if we kind of see this trend going where they just opt to disable it, especially if it were something that were kind of more necessary and kind of needed. And then like they actually kind of hinder the operating system by doing that just to not pay out. But this still, at least to me, doesn't feel like it's being oriented by we don't want to just pay out, but what they kind of want to get out of it being with the more novel exploits. And so seeing the same thing over and over, they clearly can just disable this and it's not going to have the massive impact.
That's the thing, though. Like, in a sense, your exploits will have some similarity when they are targeting bugs in the same subsystem. But the exploit strategies are not really going to be impacted that much by what subsystem is being hit. It's going to depend on the vulnerability scenarios, which, you know, again, those vulnerabilities, like IOU ring, for example, will have some vulnerabilities that are kind of specific to it and don't really transfer well to other subsystems because it's doing really weird stuff. But outside of those cases, exploitation for vulnerabilities doesn't really depend on where the vulnerability is coming from. So I feel like by eliminating these subsystems, they're going to be eliminating submission and like incoming data for that. And they're ultimately going to have less data to work with for making decisions that or like working on mitigations that they like to do. So I feel like it kind of goes against, like it flies in the face of what KCTF is trying to do in that sense.
Well, part of it though, is they're trying to secure their instances as much as they can. And so locking down their instance and being like, yeah, this is an area we don't need, makes sense with hardening. Like that has been the big thing. I feel like since stage fright happened back in, what was that, 2015 or so, like Android has just been pushed. Like, sure, they've pushed other things, but they have been pushing sandboxing. They've been pushing attack service reduction really since then, maybe before. That just feels like the turning point for me with the media system being a full compromise. So I don't know. Still in my mind, it feels fair. I could see some concern for where this may go in the future, but as long as they're kind of focusing on this is like, we want to harden our configurations and their systems, it feels rather fair for them to say, yeah, we don't need this subsystem, so we're not going to include it. It does mean that as researchers, it's not going to be a place to just burn less valuable bugs and get a decent chunk for it because, you know, they have a pretty decent payout on the exploits.
See, what's kind of interesting,
cut down on knowing about O-days there too, as you've mentioned, but they're going to be O-days that don't impact Google or don't impact like the Google setup. And sorry, I kept talking over you.
Well, I just wanted to say, like, your point with the configuration and eliminating vulnerable subsystems is a fair one. Although what's weird is that I'm pretty sure Netfilter tables originally was disabled in the KCTF, like the Kubernetes container. And then it was enabled after IOU ring was disabled. And then now they disabled Netfilter tables again. And like they enabled Netfilter tables, I'm pretty sure, after it was kind of known already that it was a bug farm. So I don't know. It's a little bit weird there. Obviously,
that I'm not sure. Google can run this. So I can't really comment on it. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, like obviously Google can run it how they want to. And if they were receiving a lot of reports there and they wanted to, you know, lock down that subsystem, like, okay, fine. That is their prerogative. But like I said, I do think it will result in less submissions because as you're eliminating these kinds of attack surfaces, you are driving the attack meta towards more of like the kernel core and you're hitting vulns that are going to be more universally applicable, which drives the value up a lot. So unless they increase their payouts, which maybe they will if that happens, you know, and if they do, fair enough. But if they don't, I think they will see like a lot less submissions, and that kind of sucks for KCTF. And part of the reason I like recommending kernel CTF to people is the fact that you can do the kernel research, you can get paid for it, and you're not limited to, you know, a super strict like sandboxing. But it seems to be moving in that direction. So, you know, we'll see, I guess. The other thing that I think was interesting was the other part that I thought about this is kind of what you were saying, where Google does have their own interests in mind here, right? They are basing this off of their kernel configuration for GKE and stuff. But KCTF benefits the Linux ecosystem as a whole, right? It gets vulnerabilities disclosed and whatnot and fixed for the kernel for everybody, not just for Google's products. Where it's getting more narrowed to Google sandboxing, it's not going to be benefiting the kernel as much. Now, there is a bit of an interesting discussion on whether Google should be expected to basically be the bankroll of Linux security. That is kind of how it's worked out. They have been the driving force behind Linux security. They've kind of positioned themselves in that seat because in general, like Linux kernel developers, except for a few of them, if we're being honest about it, they don't really care about security that much. I think a lot of the security that comes from Linux is from Google because of their interest in it, where it's used in Kubernetes and Android and Chrome OS and all these things. So it is kind of interesting on that point, too, where it's like as Google narrows their scope on this, people outside of Google are kind of getting left behind, I guess, potentially. You know, IOU ring and Netfilter tables probably aren't enabled on too many systems. But if this trend continues, it could very well trend that direction, right? So that's why I'm hoping that it isn't going to turn into whack-a-mole on the subsystem of the week sort of thing. But it does kind of look like it's going that way. So
I agree with you on, like, it would be nice if Google were to kind of fund the security on Linux. at the same time, I can't really expect a private company to do so. I think we need a better way of funding security on open source projects. Yeah, yeah, like I think there's just this systemic fault within like all communities about funding security on open source. And I don't think it's fair to really try and hold Google to doing it as much as I would like them to. And I'd love to see them even expand the bug bounty into just Linux rather than Android. But it is entirely fair as a company that they're focused on their benefit. And at least they see the benefit of like the exploit information, even if they're specific on what they're using it for. Yeah, I mean, that's, and I think that fundamental difference, I think, between us is probably where our difference in opinion comes on this, on where I guess we're putting the priority. And I'm just putting more priority and more, I guess, benefit towards just Google focusing on themselves as much as I would rather they didn't. You know, as a private company, they get to do what they want in a sense, and what they have is still great. Like, even with that, like you said, the core bugs and new vulnerabilities there are going to be reduced because there's more valuable ways to report them. But as long, I still see this as being more about the end days, more about the exploitation, which then means like they're still going to be getting that. Like, people can still exploit the core kernel end day. There's fewer of them and they're, you know, a bit more far between, but it does feel at least like it's still an option. But like I said, I do think it is a concerning trend to just see them go that route rather than pay out. It doesn't feel as wrong as like when Windows just had a bunch of those symlink issues and we're just like, yeah, we're not paying out these anymore. Well, they kind of worked on a more systemic fix. Like, that felt a bit dirty. This doesn't to me.
Yeah, the way you phrase it, which is potentially concerning, is where I would place it. Yeah, I would place the instance you talked about as worse for security researchers. But yeah, we like to talk about kernel CTF. So, you know, talk about the changes there. It is going to change the meta, as it were, with the kinds of things that are submitted to KCTF. It'll be interesting to see where it goes. What's worth mentioning is I do believe that like user namespace stuff is still enabled in the containers. So there is still some attack surface there that is maybe hittable that isn't hittable everywhere else or not a ton of other places. So that's probably where the meta is going to shift to, if I had to guess. And, you know, that might result in not getting killed too.
Although that is like, so writing an exploit that doesn't take advantage of unprivileged namespaces is a $20,000 bonus.
Yeah, they mentioned that in their rules listing.
Yeah, I've got the rules up right now and was just taking a look at that.
But you can still submit things from the user namespaces. So there is still some attack surface there that's like a bit softer, not quite like, maybe it's still in the kernel core, but it's in what's considered more privileged attack surface, so not quite as audited or whatever. There are still some avenues like that, but we'll see how long those last. I could see that being the next thing being killed. So
yeah, you know. Perhaps. It's maybe a bit harder for them to kill the namespaces just because of usage.
Where you're dealing with Kubernetes and containerization, it's probably going to be hard to get rid of that. Yeah.
Yeah, like I don't know for sure how it works. I know, like, in general, containerization has been using namespaces, but yeah, I'm not sure on the exact engineering there and how practical that would be.
It might be harder to squash it than it would be in a lot of other applications, is what you can say.
Yeah, still, like, I think a big thing that I will at least shout out here is I still think KCTF and now KVMCTF and V8CTF are good options if you're wanting to practice and learn exploit development, for taking these end days to an exploit and then getting a payout for it. Like, that is just a nice benefit here that no one else really offers.
Yeah, and I mean, the payouts are still pretty good. Like, even for O days, the payout is pretty decent compared to a lot of other places if you don't want to go to, like, gray market, you know? And there has been some, like, core kernel bugs and stuff that have been reported through it. Especially, like, if you work at a company or something and, you know, the higher paying markets aren't really available to you in those cases, then KCTF still is pretty attractive there. So yeah, I'm not saying kernel CTF is like dead by any means or like you shouldn't look at it, but you know, I'm a little bit worried. We'll see if they do the whack-a-mole thing, which, you know, I hope they don't, but it's very possible they do, and if they do, it could be less submissions.
Yeah, you know? And I think being a little bit worried is entirely fair. It's a trend that could be a sign of something bad, or it may not be.
Yeah. All right, so we'll get into some of our vulnerabilities. So up first there, we have a log me in issue, Windows kernel driver bug, and I'll let Z cover it.
Yeah, and there's kind of a couple points to this I'm going to get into. One, I'm no expert when it comes onto the Windows exploitation, so I'm not even going to make a huge attempt at explaining how you're going to go about abusing this issue, but more just focus on the bug. And the bug offers just the ability for to do a handle duplication attack. From there, you can go in, you can get a handle to whatever privileged system or leak privileged information that way. And you know, that's generally how you would do this. They talk about using the threat token for this, but with a primitive like this, there's likely many ways you could kind of go about it. Bug itself comes down to this reverse engineered code, which will, we don't have the entirety of the context and the entirety of the flow here, but ultimately it'll open a target process. It will duplicate an arbitrary handle from the process, duplicate that into target handle. It does some work with that. They decide to name the function long string off, and they just mentioned that's doing some string work with it. It's doing something with once it has the target handle, and then it closes the target handle. And during that period, due to the permission structure of the driver itself and the device itself for that log me in creates here, it is possible to open the process, the system process with the process dupe handle or whatever. Basically, you know, your process can go ahead and open this or open the device and duplicate handles that the device has. And so during this brief period where it can arbitrarily open a handle, you control what handle it's trying to open. You can then try and race this process between duplicating the object and when it closes the object. You can race that and try and duplicate it yourself by, you know, calling dupe. And that's where their attack goes into here. They have one thread that just keeps making the device ioctl call to, like, their naming of it, because we don't have the actual name, so it's just ioctl dupe lel. Kind of like the name there. That's their one thread. Their other thread here is pretty much the same thing. It's just trying to call duplicate handle. Yeah. While loop, and just tries to duplicate the handle. Doing basically the same thing, and you're racing that period. They do a little bit about trying to predict what the handle is going to be so they can call it before it happens and like actually race it. A little bit of work on there, but ultimately this is just the device is, I don't know what it's doing or what the purpose of this code is, and they don't seem to know, but it is doing that, which lets them get this, make the system process duplicate an arbitrary handle so it can do pretty much anything since it's system. And the fact they let you duplicate handles out of it then mean like you can do your own privilege escalation from there. Kind of just a stupid bug, but also a bug class or bug style that we've talked about race conditions plenty, so that's not novel. But the handle duplication is kind of more of a more Windows folks thing. I guess you could maybe do some like file pointer stuff as like a Linux-ish equivalent, but it's just a very different setup than Linux anyhow. Like
you can do some race stuff with like FD install. There has been some posts on that, but it's not quite the same.
The whole security strategy. Yeah, the whole security model is very different on Linux when it comes to this. Like we don't have that same concept of like the process or like the tokens and stuff. So definitely different, but I thought this was kind of a fun bug to call out. And I'll be honest, this was a bit of a slow week. But yeah, I
remember from your prep stream, like you spent quite a lot of time trying to get topics together, and it was difficult. Sometimes that happens. So it is a little bit Windows specific, and that is an area that Z and I don't have quite as much experience in. But it seems like a pretty cool bug.
It's honestly Windows specific. I think it's worth checking out. But it's not Windows kernel specific. Like, I don't like covering bugs when it's really specific on the internals of anything. But you could apply this elsewhere. There are going to be other things that you might be able to raise the dupe handle on or duplicate handle on. Like, you know, you might be able to take that elsewhere. And I just want to call out one thing. You know, I just thought it was funny as I was reading this. They were kind of describing, you know, they're going through walking through what they're doing, where they're predicting what the handle value is going to be. They're creating the race thread. The design consideration of the racing thread is due to the following. They have a single point. I am bad at exploiting race conditions. That said, I think their strategy is fair. I mean, they're using effectively shared memory to set the flag on when to stop, so it's going to be performant on that front. And you can't improve the performance of your syscalls, really. Like, they're... You're not really... It's not really your choice. Like, honestly?
Yeah, I mean...
That's all you can do.
Generally with races, like, you can do tricks. Like, you can do CPU core stalling and try to do some scheduler manipulation to try to make things happen in a certain order. But ultimately, like, if it works, which is something kind of dumb, like using shared memory in a flag, like, do it. I think generally with racing, you want to keep it as simple as possible where you can. You only resort to using all those tricks if you really need to, for, like, reliability reasons or whatever. But if something simpler like this works, yeah, that's totally fair.
Yeah, and this seems to have a fair race window because you do have the long string off beforehand, so it's not like it's, you know, open and closed.
Yeah, and something like string processing generally is going to be heavier on processing time. So
yeah, you know, completely fair, and as usual with Loft exploits, if it works, it works. You know, that's all you need. You need the exploit to land as long as it does that. You know, stability's kind of thing, but you can do this repeatedly without crashing it, so... Yeah, I mean...
It's a safe race to lose, it seems like, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a bit of a laugh out of that, but I mean, it's... Yeah, it's totally fair. I mean, take your wins when you get them. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was at least a little bit of a fun bug to cover here, but there isn't a lot that I can say or really get into with it.
Yeah.
I would like to know a little bit more about why they let you open the process with privilege to duplicate handles from it. Like, that does feel like a very weird thing for them to allow. They just call it out as the obviously poor decision. Well, in lack of proper access control, then the obviously poor decision to duplicate user-specified handles, which is another thing that just feels so weird. Like, why are they doing this? But yeah, I don't know.
My guess is some legacy inherited thing, but yeah.
Yeah, like, it does feel very weird. It feels like a very stupid issue, but yeah.
So out of Project Zero, we have another kernel bug, this time on the Linux side. And these were bugs reported in the MediaTek WLAN kernel driver on Android, which can be accessible from untrusted app contexts on some older SDK-compiled apps. And these bugs, again, kind of like what I said at the top of the episode, they're another instance where you have kernel bugs that are impacting the user space, as they can allow overflow into user land memory via the virtualfs or vfs read handlers for some of the files in WLAN's procfs directory. The ones that they call out here are ones like proc country read and proc mcr read. The problem there is the user land buffer size just isn't checked, and so if you can pass a file descriptor to one of these files into a privileged process and have it read it, you could get memory corruption in that privileged process, which on Android is pretty feasible through IPC. You know, it sounds like something initially that isn't super useful. You know, it's sort of a self-attack scenario, right? You open a file descriptor and you can overflow your own user space process memory. Generally, that's not getting you anything. But when you factor in the IPC aspect and the fact that you can actually pass file descriptors into other processes in like an Android binder IPC setup, the whole thing there is you can send specialized messages where the kernel will basically install that backing file that your process is using into the file descriptor table that other process. And so when you can do that, you can kind of, you know, get that attack across processes, and that can allow for privilege escalation if you're calling into a more privileged process. So yeah, not a ton of information there. It is like, sounds very straightforward, just like a straightforward buffer overflow in user space, but how it can be leveraged is kind of interesting and feasible.
Yeah, I think the leverage is kind of interesting. Yeah, when I first pulled this up, I'm like, oh, I basically said what you called out. I was like, oh, I can exploit myself. I can, you know, corrupt my own data. Like, yay. But yeah, when you think about file descriptors, there are ways that you would be able to leverage this. It would be interesting to see, like, try and take this to an actual exploit, like, in another program, and how you could leverage its read. You know, you get the overflow, but you don't have, like, very good control over the data being written and stuff. It would be interesting to see it get exploited, or to see somebody attempt to exploit it.
You might need like an info disclosure or something, because depending on where you're overflowing, like, I think they smash a stack canary in their POC actually. So like, you have things like stack canaries And then even if it's not on the sack, you know, you might have to worry about other things and manipulating the heap. So yeah, I'm not sure how easy it would be to actually exploit, but in some cases, I would believe it would be possible.
Yeah, like it's definitely an interesting bug. Not everything's like, it depends on the user on program if it's going to have smashing or not. I believe they specifically wrote their bug to have it as like evidence that it did happen. But yeah, it's, I don't know, it feels like that interesting primitive that would be fun to play around with in a scenario, like to have that as an exploit. That's kind of more where I'm taking is like, I don't know, it's a fun primitive that I don't know how I would immediately be able to exploit. It is going to depend a bit on like what degree of control you have over the data. But yeah, it's just interesting, I guess.
Yeah, and another interesting aspect of it that we haven't mentioned yet, I think you might have mentioned this on your prep stream, though, is that there was a bit of a disagreement between Project Zero and MediaTek here, because MediaTek did not really consider this to be an issue. They said they don't believe it's possible to corrupt the memory of another process, and so this got disclosed after a 7-day embargo because of that. So, yeah, I mean, one of those issues where it's because it's like a do not fix or whatever, or a won't fix, maybe you could try to take it to an exploit and see where you can use it, because MediaTek doesn't seem to consider it an issue. So, but yeah, Project Zero kind of disagrees. They say that we believe that this issue could be able to cause use of that memory corruption of higher privileged processes on Android via binder IPC or Unix domain sockets if they can get, you know, that file read. So,
yeah. I think it's definitely possible. It just, it's a weird primitive to have.
Oh, yeah. But I think MediaTek is wrong here. Straight
it's up. MediaTek, let's be honest there. I find it interesting that it's just a 7-day embargo. That kind of surprises me a little bit.
I think that might have been talked about. It was a long time ago now when we covered Project Zero's policy changes. But I think it was something to the effect of if the vendor doesn't agree it's an issue or whatever, they reduce the embargo to 7 days.
So, oh, was that? Maybe it was. Maybe it was
something I think that like was that. In their policy changes from a few years ago.
Because I was saying that's closer to like the in the wild exploit embargo period. But yeah, I do recall that they did make some changes about that. So maybe you're right.
Yeah, that's the two main issues that we had for today. Like Z said, it was a bit of a slow week. Didn't have a ton to cover. But, you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. We do have a few shoutouts, though, as well. One of them was that the Pocker GTFO, so they released a new issue. It's been a few years. Their last issue was in 2022. You can check it out if you know, you're interested in like those zines and whatnot. There's one, I haven't read through everything in it, but there was one post that I liked, which was by Travis Goodspeed on his mask ROM tool for extracting bits and stuff from mask ROMs and dealing with some of the problems you have with stitching and whatnot. So yeah, there's some cool reads in there from some very knowledgeable people. I think, Z, you had something that you found interesting in there too, right?
Yeah, there was a post. I forget the name of it now, actually.
It was the XCFG, I think, right?
Yeah, it was about XFG, Microsoft's like extended flow guard. I just forget the exact name of it. Either way, it was about like, I was kind of hoping it would be about like something with breaking it. It's abusing XFG. Kind of hope it'd be there, but instead it's more about like how the extent flow guard can actually assist with the reverse engineering and kind of taking advantage of its presence to tell you information about the binary. It was just a different approach from what I was expecting. It was kind of an interesting read though, so you can check it out.
Yeah, I read a bit about that one, and it talked about some of the specifics of how XCFG was implemented and with the like the hashing and everything. And because it had that table of valid call targets, you could kind of leverage that with reverse engineering to solve some of the issues with indirection and whatnot. So yeah, that was a cool read too. I'm sure there's other really cool stuff in there, but yeah, I just haven't gotten through it all. But we like to shout out these kinds of things when they when a new release is issued, especially where it's been a few years. Another shout out that we have was a post from IOActive on exploring AMD platform secure boot. So this has a fair amount of overlap with the presentation that IOActive gave at Hardware IO. So this is talking about AMD's secure boot process, kind of lower level than what most people are used to. So it talks about at the UEFI level and DXCs and whatnot, basically right after the PSP or platform security processor passes over control to the x86. And they talk a lot about how the x86 talks to the PSP to do like attestation and just ensuring the verification of the binaries that are loaded and such, where you have a lot of vendors and whatnot, that gets pretty complicated. And the types of issues they talk about here are like problems where there's IOMMU registers, sorry, not IOMMU, there's MMIO registers, memory mapped IO registers, for like locking down the configuration of, you know, very privileged registers. And some vendors just don't lock those down. So because you can take advantage of those, you can do some pretty powerful stuff and, you know, subvert the secure boot. So yeah, there's some cool stuff there. Not a ton of new stuff, I don't think. Like I said, I think a lot of this stuff was kind of covered in their presentation, and it's a continuation of a previous blog post they made. But there's some cool stuff there. And if you're interested in the like platform secure boot and secure boot in general, there'll be some interesting stuff in there for you. So yeah, that's all the topics we have for this week. As always, thanks goes out to everyone who tuned in. Previous episodes can be found on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. You can join our community by joining the Discord. Discord and Twitter links are in the description. And with that said, we'll see you next week.